You're listening to Nakedly Examined Music, a podcast about songs and songwriters. My name is Mark Lintonmeyer. My guest for episode 239 is Adrian Sherwood, best known as a producer with a distinctive dub mixing style. He's worked with Ministry, Depeche Mode, Skinny Puppy, Sinead O'Connor, Primal Scream, and a variety of reggae artists. You're right now hearing Movement in Space by Creation Rebel from their album Starship Africa 1980, which, as he will tell us, is not just a project that he came on and produced. It is his project. He has many, many releases, often just attributed to his record label On You Sound. He's a key member and composer for African Head Charge, a group we featured on this podcast. He didn't start releasing music under his own name until 2003's Never Trust a Hippie, and now has 9 LPs under his own name and has remixed, reissued some of his other material for his 5 Decades of Destruction series of EPs. Today we're going to discuss Body Roll from his new record, The Collapse of Everything, then Starship Bahia from Survival and Resistance 2012, then Sharp as a Needle from an album called The English Disease from 1989 that he released under the band name Barmy Army, and we'll conclude by listening to one of his many, many collaborations, Make Up Your Mind by Cole Cut and the Ninja Tunes, On You Sound, Cecile, Todd Lattie, and Adrian Sherwood from the album Outside the Echo Chamber 2017. For more information, please see adriansherwood.com. For more about this podcast, see nakedlyexaminedmusic.com or support the effort at patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. All right, I will have played a little bit during my introduction of Movement in Space by Creation Rebel that you produced from their Starship Africa 1978 album. Well, actually, it's the remix for your Adrian's 5 Decades of Destruction 80s 2024 release. We're going to get quickly to the new stuff, but I wanted to present something of the arc. Obviously, you've done a lot of production. I try my best with these interviews to like listen through the artist catalog. You have way too many things, way too many remixes, way too, you know, there's no way.
Sorry.
But I tried to get a representative sampling. I'll refer folks to the interview with Bonjo from African Head Charge that I did last year or so. The regular listeners have heard a good amount of what you do sort of in support of other artists or, you know, where somebody else initiates the song. Do you want to say a little bit about, like, for instance, this Creation Rebel thing, you know, as it relates to what you're doing now?
Well, this record actually came out in 1980, but we recorded it in 78. It was one of my first ventures into a recording studio. So what I did, I hired all the musicians, hummed the bass lines to the bass player. And the bass player on this album was Tony Henry from Misty In Root, a very, very important band. And this was his first time in a studio. I created it as a studio project and called it Creation Rebel. And a year or two later, it evolved into a live band. So again, like with Head Charge, it wasn't a band to start with. It was a studio project and then it evolved into a band. So a lot of the things I was doing was just having fun in a studio. And years later, people come back and say, oh, I love that record. You know, and you think, oh, we made that really quickly and did it for fun and everything. And then people say, oh, that's my favourite record you ever did. And you think, well, we did that in about 4 days and roughneck, but that's how life is. Sometimes your early things, people, it has an impact on them. And then, hey.
Do you even keep track of sort of how many albums that you have put out? Or is the line between what counts as your album and some sort of collaboration too difficult? And a lot of them are not albums, they're individual tracks. Yeah. How do you think of your catalog?
Well, basically, there's the On You catalog. When I started, I was broke. You know, I made that album for next to nothing, you know, the Starship. And dubbed from Creation on those records. So I was at the time licensing records to other companies that I lost copyright on them to like companies like Cherry Red, who I won't speak about. I was making records really quickly, but I was trying to build a catalogue and get noticed. I think it's like any young musician now or producer, what your challenge is to get anyone to notice you even exist. And back in those days, when I was 19, 20, it was exactly the same. You know, you're competing with these amazing records coming from America and Jamaica and all over the world. And you've got to make yourself stand out from the pack. And I was just literally borrowing from Peter to pay Paul to make another record, to build a catalogue and get noticed. That was the model I had. So I did make a lot of records, a lot of them in 2, 3, 4 days each album, just by recording really interesting musicians and treating the sound like a dub record myself.
Well, let's fast forward to The Collapse of Everything, 2025. We're going to hear Body Roll in a second here. Sounds very through composed. But yeah, can you say a little about sort of how this new project relates to all that stuff? Is this fundamentally a new kind of thing? I heard even Howard sent an email that you're playing live with a band, with Doug Wimbish and other folks for the first time. Is this?
Yes. Well, what's happened is when we had On You Sound in the early days and before that hit run, I would mix the band. I would be there with Prince Farai, Bim Sherman, whoever, Mark Stewart, the Tackhead lads. I would be the extra member of the band because I'd be doing very active physical live dubs from a mixing desk. Some years later when I made Never Trust a Hippie, I kept getting booked. Oh, can you come and do a DJ gig? Can you do a DJ gig? But if your name's on the back of a sleeve, they don't know you. They know African Head Charge, perhaps, or any one of the numerous names we traded under. They would know those names because that was the band, but you on the back as a producer, it's a lot different to me having my name on the front of a record. So the plan now is I'm going to take it one stage further, go on stage with the mixing desk where I've got all the drums and certain parts, a drum pad, 3 reverbs, 2 or 3 delays, a noise bank, plus a guitarist, saxophone, flute player who plays both, and the great Doug Wimbish. A wonderful light show. I make a cacophony of audiovisual attack. That's the plan, what I want to do. I'm starting with some shows in November in Japan and then doing a big show in London. But in March next year, I'm coming to the States for the first time in many years doing shows, starting at the Big Ears Festival. Then we're going to do a show in LA and another one in Brooklyn. And hopefully San Francisco as well, all in a week. I'll be coming with my engineer, just the two of us, but with a really brilliant visual show. I'll have build a studio on stage and doing a live show. It's all economics at the end of the day. I'd like to do the elaborate full band show in the States, but I've got to build up for it because I haven't been there for so long. And also paying a very large amount of money to get work permits for my engineer and me. And it's very tough playing the States now from where we are.
Well, can you say a few words before we hear it about Body Roll in particular? What folks can expect?
Body Roll is one of the tracks from my new album, The Collapse of Everything. This features Alex White, who's an incredible, wonderful, really great sax player and flute, and he's contributing a lot to the production we've been doing lately. And this is like a jazz-flavoured groove track with Keith LeBlanc, rest in peace, and Dougie on bass. It's a lovely little piece of music. We'll be right back.
All right, so kind of a nice somber semi-accordion sort of thing before we get the lead. What sort of flute is he playing? Do you even know? It seems a little extra low.
That's a weird keyboard that he's got.
Okay. But so they... Ba-da-da-da-da-da-da. Okay.
Yeah, it's a funny keyboard, and it was slightly out of tune, so we had to bend it and just get it in tune. But it had a really lovely little flavor to start the tune off.
So, okay, so that's that initial thing that we hear.
Yes.
When he eventually comes in with his... The melody, the da-da-da-da-da-da-da. That's actual flute, though, right? It does sound...
Yes,
okay.
It is, yeah.
All right. He's also layering with the saxes and things, or did you have other folks or samples for...
No, that's Alex as well. And then we've got Bandola playing the guitar. And Mark's, I call him my little pet hippie. I love Mark. He's a Canadian and he lives near us. And he had a band many years ago called The Lucy Show, which I don't think many people remember, but it was a decent band. But he's a really good lad and he brings a real... different sonic to the things for me. So the pair of them are great. Alex is very interesting. His dad was saxophone player in Dire Straits. He's a good player. So very good caliber musician and young. And it's good to, as you get older, surround yourself with some youngsters as well, with a bit of energy.
How about the rhythm bed that you start off with here? Is this just all you programming? Or is there any actual drummer on this?
It's a live track. That's Keith LeBlanc, who died last year.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. He was a drummer in Sugar Hill, played on all those records like White Lines and The Message, and he played sessions for everybody. He was like a brilliant player.
So the bongo layer, the little other things, is that overdubbed or is that also part of the live?
I think Keith overdubbed that as a little touch to his own drums.
The rhythm sensibility throughout your stuff seems pretty consistent, obviously, as the technology gets much better. And a lot of that has to do with, you know, your choice of reverbs and things. Are you generally choosing to work with a live drummer whenever possible? Or what's your philosophy of this?
It is all down to budgets and what I want to do myself or what somebody perhaps might want me to do if I was producing them. But very often now, people, even with live musicians, tend to record to a grid because it's so much easier to manipulate it after. And I've worked with drummers like Style Scott, who we would never record to a grid, but he's so accurate. The movement in the tempo is so minimal, you know, just absolutely brilliant. Keith, who played on this track, he's actually playing to a grid, to a click. Keith was a metronome man. He was one of those guys who was on the spectrum. You know, he'd have different beats going with his both hands and both feet. He's an amazing, amazing player. To be honest with you, I missed from the old days when we did go in, it was just spend a while getting the mics set up to record everybody live, record it, overdub it and mix it, or record it a couple of times, manipulate, tape manipulation. Those days, I do miss them. But where we're at the moment, there's all the blessings of all the new technology as well. If somebody said, would you like to record a band with a live drummer and great musicians, and we've got a really interesting project, I'd be a whoopee, because it saves messing about trying to tart up, you know, something and make it sound good, you know, for hours and hours. The easiest thing is just get the great musicians in, get everybody feeling they can create some magic, mic it up properly, record it, re-record it if you have to, and then, right, this is feeling fantastic, and then keep going till the very last stage, which is, you know, finally my time to finish it off, perhaps with an analog mix, and that's producing live musicians. It's great. I like the marriage of both still. I'm not complaining.
Yes, and an obvious thing, just the fact that the hi-hats are going, emphasizing the hits and, you know, the left hand being a little lighter about it, that, you know, an obvious thing that drummers do, but that at least last time I was seriously using drum machines was like 1989. So the drum machines at that point would be, you know, and that was kind of some of the appeal was that it was, you know, inhuman in this way.
Well, Keith was a master. He had a DMX drum machine when I met him in 84. And he was just killing on it. He did all those songs like Malcolm X, No Sellout, and all those other tunes. That was Keith, made those records as well. And he was brilliant at programming drums. But up to that point, I'd never recorded. The first time I ever recorded a drum machine, I think, was 83. And prior to that, the 6 years before that, everything was live. But, you know, this, you go back and discover some of the ancient drum machine sounds, and they sound really cool when you blend them in with what you're doing now. Take aspects of the past and future ideas as well. So
So to what extent on this are you, again, humming the things? I imagine the lead flute part is something, a melody that you came up that with that you're humming. What about like the bass?
My contribution writing on this one wasn't as much as on a lot of the other tracks, to be honest. But I did contribute to the melodies, and Dougie and I did the B-line. So certain tunes I steer from word dot, and other songs we work on together. I'm not a musician, and I never have been, and I'm not going to be. I'm more a person who hears something and wants to see it through. So on this album, because I'm calling all the shots, I got to do what I wanted to do, which is nice.
So like these piano hits, is that you playing or is that somebody else or is that just programming?
No, it's somebody playing. That's live in a nice studio.
So there's a lot, of course, throughout all the songs, there's these little gestures of things that you're, so is this is the thing that you're spending hours and hours on after the time, because I can hear the fundamental, you know, jazzy live thing, but then you're going in and, yeah, can you say a little about the steps in the process between recording these guys live and the final bit?
It's really funny you're asking me this the question. Nobody's asked me the question like that, how you visualized it, but it's true. I look on everything as a picture. So if I'm trying to record, you know, a pad, you want the pad to be a colour that you like. And if you want to bend the pad and weave it using equalisation or certain effects that I like, it's all a process of painting a picture. That's the only way I see it. So on that one, I think I broke the rhythm down and reintroduced the keyboard from the beginning in a different, you know, in that section of the tune. And then I was spinning the drums a little bit, and then putting it, you know, using a Grampian spring and another one of my favorite effects, a Zen delay, and just warping the sound.
The spring reverb? What's the Grampian spring?
The Grampian's a spring reverb. It's
okay.
The thing is with the analog, I've got all these great machines and they make one sound, you know, one sound, but it's a good sound. So I use it on lots of things, you know, and then now there's some incredible plugins. There's so many brilliant plugins.
Yeah, no, I can't be bothered to, like, I mean, are you still doing things like, okay, I'm going to have this track come out of a little speaker and I'm going to mic it over here so I can get that specific spring reverb and sound of this. Like, are you doing anything like that? Or that's, because then you have to get up from the keyboard, you know?
Well, I don't play a keyboard. So
I play it from the computer, I should say. The computer keyboard.
Well, I don't operate the computer.
Oh,
I've
okay.
I've got my engineer who does it. So I'll talk to Matt about what we want to achieve. We'll do it. But I've got so much experience and I know what I don't want. So I've always got my ears open to a young musician coming in with the melody. And then you share some writers with him. And then you always push yourself to get something to where you want to hear it in the finished thing. But I'm using old machines here, really cheap, great ones, as well as the expensive ones. A Grampian now is very expensive, but I got it for £50. It's worth a few grand now. But, you know, there's wonderful machines like the TC EQ, the really old one. You can get it for about $100. And what I always like to do with that is overload the input. So drive a voice or a bass or a piano into it, turn down the output so it's completely overloaded, then EQ it into like a delay and a reverb, and you create some tortured sound where you're making the music almost bleed in a really healthy way. You're having it, if that's the right word. That's what I like doing. And then processing certain things using techniques of creating a playoff sound where you turn a tape over and record the reverb backwards and have it playing forwards and then with your fingers move it and weave it in and out to create an ambience. That kind of stuff fascinates me still and I still love it. And I know it will always sound good. So when I'm trying to get a rhythm to feel a bit more mystic or stuff, I'll be using a lot of techniques like that.
This makes it less surprising that you mentioned doing an analog mix. So what does that actually mean for you? Is it like recording out to a tape machine of some sort?
Basically, we've got lots of delays, lots of reverbs, lots of phasers, flanges, distortion boxes, some wonderful cinema engineering EQ stuff from the States. It's very hard to get now that you know, Langevin EQs and things, and then, you know, which gives you that Tubby, King Tubby kind of sound. So, you know, you can't do that in a computer. You just can't do it. In the studio, we do all the preparation, the editing, tidying up certain effects. But then by the finished time, we spread 24 channels on the desk plus another 20 of returns for effects. And then I mix it with my hands.
So when you're mixing it with your hands, is it capturing at least so you don't have to redo it? Is there some sort of digital connection, or you just have to do it again? Okay.
You do it again. So what you do, it's my time then, you know, so there's no musicians around, everyone's done their job. It's just me and my engineer together, and then...
All right, so you do have four hands. You don't have just your hands.
No, I'll be mixing it. He'll be running the computer to store it. But what I'll do, I'll maybe do three mixes.
Mm-hmm.
I'll do one mix, not straight, but, you know, where I'm dubbing it and affecting it. Then I'll do two, maybe three more, which get more and more drastic. Then I'll listen back to them and say, okay, I like the intro of the first mix or the third mix. And then I like, as the main mix, I really like mix three or four, but I like this bit of that one, and I'll just edit them together and make a picture. But very often I might just use one mix. It just sounds, oh, well, that one's just perfect from beginning to end, because you don't want it to feel too jerky, you know.
I guess the fact that you have unlimited channels makes it a little easier. I'm just thinking back to using a four track in the early 90s. We would use one track for so many things that it would be maybe three or four of us just, okay, kind of going. It's like a choreography, it's like a dance routine. Okay, when we get to the chorus, I'm going to inch up a half a decibel. You know,
to get this
track,
right. Yeah.
And try to just get it right once. And I was so excited to like have, oh, I have a DAW and I can just sort of do the mix bit by bit. And then it is, you know, redo it as many times as you want. But it sounds like there's something essential to your creative process that rules out that kind of mechanization.
Well, I like things being slightly unbalanced, just off, you know, leaping out at you. So I always try and get that element of surprise and not aggression, there's something to leap out the speakers at you. That's what I'm looking for. And I want things bright and crispy and, you know, sonic. Like I said earlier, like a picture, I hear the snare above your head, things underneath there, and then you want other things to appear right in the background. And that's what I've always tried to do.
Let's stop for some ads. This episode is brought to you by Square. Your favorite neighborhood spots run on Square. I want to talk to you about record shops, the place where you go that still has vinyl, the place where you might even still buy used CDs, not because they're not on the streaming services, but because you wouldn't think to look for them. These browsing experiences have for me been absolutely formative in all the places I have lived. They make the neighborhood a cool place to be. There's a good chance that your favorite band only exists because there was some record shop that these guys hung out at. I'm thinking of Husker Du in particular as one of my favorites. A place where people could bond over music in a physical space. These places become an extension of your home, and when these neighborhood businesses thrive, the whole neighborhood thrives. They, of course, need your support. And if you spend money in the neighborhood, it stays in the neighborhood. So I want you to take this ad as an excuse for you to go support your favorite local music listening spot. Have yourself a day in the neighborhood. Square is a proud partner of more than 4 million neighborhood businesses around the world. You can go to square.com/go/NEM to learn more. That is lowercase NEM. But before you do, go support your favorite neighborhood spot. You'll be happy you did. Let's get a second song out there. One of your most popular songs, at least according to Spotify, your Starship Bahia.
Bahia is a place in Brazil.
Okay. Bahia from Survival and Resistance 2012. Yeah, you want to say a few words about this, the palette that you were using for this in the time you were recording this before we hear it?
Well, this one, I'd got invited to go to Brazil. I'd not been to Brazil before, and I met some great musicians out there, Simone Sol and Guilherme Arantes, who kindly played the piano on that for me. He was the piano player. He's like a legend in Brazil. And because I'd done the album Starship Africa, so I thought we'd call it Starship Bahia, because I used the same approach with some backward mixing techniques and things on it. I think it's a beautiful piece of music.
Thank you.
So you've kind of answered my main question with this whole thinking of things visually, because I found this one much more frustrating than the last one to try to take notes on the arrangement, because there's so many little like characters walking past that, okay, I know there's a delay involved with this somehow, but it's some sort of low vacuum cleaner noise. What, if, you know, that there's a lot of identifiable characters. And what you were saying about the mixing, right? Some of this piano is very jarring because it's, you know, very nice and smooth. And then, it's, you know, something will jump out at you and will kind of...
Well, hopefully it's pleasant. Yes. Hopefully pleasantly.
Yes, yes. That's a, you know, overall very cool vibe. So this is a still based around a reggae thing to the point of the timbales.
The thing is, like, people always say reggae, this and that. It's just like, kind of, I've done folk records, jazz mm-hmm. records, African records, industrial records. But my, you know, my, where I started was Jamaican stuff, which I still have got a real love of every period of Jamaican music. Like, there's things I love and there's other things that I don't love so much, but that is where I started, and I will always give the greatest respect and everything to. But like, the interesting thing is, you speaking is, you know, when you make records yourself and do music, I sit there and I hear and I go, okay, it's gonna go 1, 2, 3, 4, and then you know what's coming next. How often do you hear production? You know bloody well what's about to happen. So I try to consciously make things happen ahead of the four, or twist it before, or hit the one and then remove what happens next and turn it round and spin it, so that other producers and other people can listen all they like and they won't be able to figure it out always. That I do consciously, because I want it to entertain me, and I also want it other musicians and music makers, I want them to listen to what we do and think, oh, that's interesting, oh, that's interesting, oh, that's great. You know, because it's very often the form, you know, forget the chart stuff, because I've never been that successful with particularly chart things, but you hear everything, it's like, God, you've heard it all before, you know the structure, and you know what's about to happen. I want the element of surprise, and I want to achieve the mystic thing of it, the spiritual thing of it, the fun thing of it, and I like the mischief of things that don't quite add up.
That's really interesting to you know, I as an external person who does not listen to a lot of reggae, I sort of think about reggae as like blues, like exactly like you're saying. Like, I don't play blues because, even though I really enjoy some blues, and of course it's like a great emotional outlet, but a lot of blues songs sound basically the same, and I guess I was feeling that with reggae, but you just use these bare bones reggae gestures, you know, okay, it gets, you know, it's like a dance beat, you know, just something to then have this giant canvas that you can do literally anything with.
Well, what kind of music do you like? What's your favorite?
I mean, it's probably just as formulaic, this sort of three chord post-punk rock and roll, add a knife here and there, that kind of thing.
No, fair enough, but you see, if you're passionate about it, you'd introduce me to loads of things I've never heard before, and I could get into it. If you were amongst me, and I was at my house, say, and I sat down, and I played you some of the greatest examples of dub or great songs you've never heard before by brilliant Jamaican songwriters, you know, great songs, not gimmicky, or gimmicky ones. Or I could play you like some of the funniest gimmicky records from the 60s to the 70s, the 80s, some funny, hilarious stuff. You'd probably go, rock, I really get it. I love this stuff. Similarly, English folk music or all sorts of stuff. You know, the Jamaican saying, each one teach one. You know, you could turn me onto some great stuff I've never, ever heard. There's so much wealth of music. But with what my reference points on it, they're all based in some, in my opinion, very healthy production houses globally. You know, I love things from the States that are nothing to do with what people might think I've used. You know, I was always interested in oddball things, you know, from Link Wray to The Residents to, you know, on and on and on. Bits of this, bits of that, Captain Beefheart, The Cramps. I liked all sorts of things early on, but I wasn't obsessed with them. You know, I just like, oh, that's cool, because my mates were playing them to me. I didn't discover them. You know, you always, someone in a record shop or a friend turns you on to something, and I could go on and on, but my starting point was a lot of the, you know, Tamla and James Brown and thinking when I was a schoolboy. And years later, you start hearing all, you know, Iggy Pop and all these like great thing, New York Dolls and all these like other things that you get what the British lads were copying, you know, in their bands, you know.
Yeah, that's really interesting. The whole, you know, somebody turns you on to the music in the first place, but it's a matter of which music you sort of actually internalize and really make, you know, get obsessed about, as you were saying, such that it goes completely round and round. And for me, yeah, Residents was one of those bands that nobody told me this is a great band. It's just something I sort of discovered in like my public library and then at the school radio station at college, and so it felt like a, you know, this secret discovery that I, you know, could really pour into. I feel like that is a, yeah, there's something about this illusory independence of thought that maybe gives one a greater attachment to a type of music than otherwise you might have.
100%.
Turning back to the, so even just the triangle track on this song, on Starship Bahia, was the same person doing all the percussion, or were you drawing on multiple local percussionists, you recall at this?
No, I used a female percussionist from Sao Paulo, Simone Sol. But I again was getting her to do frequency things. So if you're listening to a tune and you want it to shine, triangle is like an unusual trebly percussions that have certain frequencies. How you use them, it's key, really.
It's this this counter rhythm that you're introducing that I was particularly.
Do you like it?
Yes. I mean, one of the kind of things, it's a really groovy, smooth tune. Just to have something like that, that's really breaking it up is nice.
Well, giving you my production tips, that's to do with tape manipulation.
Hmm. So it's not an analog or a digital delay pedal.
No. I can tell you what you do, but it's actually very, very fiddly. But you have to, if you understand delay, if you know, for example, that a tune, say, 120 beats per minute,
mm-hmm.
and you know that a 16th note in delay, would you know what that is? It's 125 milliseconds.
No, I would not have known that offhand. I could do the math. I could sit down.
But... Well, because it's 120 beats per minute, you know, it's going to be 60. And it's in the multiples coming down. 125 is, this is a very boring interview now. It's the boring thing. I always like using a dotted delay.
So an actual piece of tape that you're doing something, what is it?
What you do, if you take a tape, turn it over, and then record the delay backwards, when you turn the tape back over, it goes, and it cuts back on you. So if you record two or three different delay speeds backwards and then turn the tape over, it's going to go, it's made off it. Or if you do a reverb, it's going to go, or a piano, instead of going, jong, it's going to go, jong. So you get this weaving sound. So using backward reversed, swept, EQ, moved, reverbs and delays, it's a little bit fiddly, but that's what I've been doing for 45 years. For years. That's one of my little tricks, but it sure makes the most interesting rhythms. You can hear examples of it on the new album, The Collapse of Everything, on like Dub Inspector, for example. That's built off using ricochets and reverse impressions of the groove we already had.
Okay, so it sounds like most of these little characters that are traveling in the song are just what the musicians were doing, but you're taking a little bit of them. So, you know, I can tell that the guitar timbre of something that's going wah, 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 you know, is what the guy was playing, you know, two measures ago or something. So you're just taking, it's not importing a new sound through your synth library or something.
It's part of my production technique that I'm processing very drastically each thing that is there. And not always. I mean, sometimes I keep the productions very simple and just use the tone. And, you know, if I'm making like an album like I did with the Jeb Loy Nichols album, you know, that's quite simple, but I'm still using certain techniques on it. But it's not appropriate to do on everything. So.
So yes, a lot of the slurping with the various timbres.
Like
I do. Yes, so that's just exactly what we're talking about. That is also the reversing the reverb and things like that. Or do you recall?
What it requires really is the analog desk. So you go from is this a tech program?
We can go any direction.
Or am I just teaching you how to make dub records backwards?
It's a fascinating group. Go ahead.
All right. You make a record yourself. Have you got an analog in and out of your computer? Probably not.
I definitely have outbuses, but I have never used them ever because I don't own any pedals that I think, this is such a precious sound. But that's pretty much all I own in terms of analog effects are these things that I bought in high school, in college, that I maybe will still use on stage, but I'm not going to I'm just going to use the digital plugin for.
Well, all right, if you're using just the digital, all you do is play your rhythm backwards, okay? Make it play backwards.
Mm-hmm.
And then, for example, get a reverb you like, and then put the on every fourth snare, say.
Hmm.
And then do another take where you've got a dotted eighth delay, and put that on every second snare, every four bars or something, or two. Print that, and then do another one where you've got a really fast delay going, like a 16th, but with a bit of feedback on it, and print that backwards as well. Then turn the tape over and have a listen to what you've got. Wipe what you don't want, keep what you do want, and re-edit it into make a new rhythm. And that's what I do. But it's like, there's the secret, it's given away. Go and do it. That's it, that's on that record.
All right, very cool.
That technique's used on two or three tracks on the new album. And every time I'm trying to make the rhythm so that it doesn't sound like everybody else's stuff, that's what I try and do.
So this is the most spastic triangle part here, and it sort of goes into a train crossing sound. Let's hear. Yeah, any thought about that sequence there?
Same way. That's the same way. But that's a really slow one. So it's coming way before the actual hit. So it's coming from the distance and building up.
Well, and the actual train sound, that's got to be a sample or something.
No, it's not a train sound. No? It's not a train sound. That's the delay. Because it's running as a dotted eighth or a slow dotted eighth at half speed. So if you were running at 120, it would be 375. But if you're doing a slow one, it would be 750. You understand? It's at 1/16th.
Sure.
At 120 is 125. So a dotted eighth is 3/125, which is 375. And a half speed one, which that was, would be 750. You start feeding it back and feeding it back. And then luckily I created that sound. I thought, wow, that sounds amazing. And then edited it and put it in the right place. It's a bit of work. I like it, but not enough other people do. Otherwise, I'd have been a multi-millionaire. But I don't care. I like it.
All right, let me ask a general question of if you have any thoughts on how long to keep one of these things going. Our first song was a nice little pop song length, 3.5 minutes. This one goes almost 5.5. Yeah, when I was talking about African Head Charge, he was like, oh yeah, what Bonji would send you were these 10, 20 minute, these long drum jamming sessions and that you're deciding what counts as a palatable length.
Well, it doesn't. I mean, they weren't all made like that.
Okay.
I can tell you. He sent me a couple of things from Africa on the last album. The other records we made in England, and we just build them a different way. But each one's made a different way. If he had some ideas, we'd work for his ideas, and we'd get him to manifest percussions and beats on the ideas that I had for other things. I didn't take hours of things and edit them down. I think, Starship Bahia benefits from being very long because it's a very tripped out, Smokey Bear type track. Other tunes, you don't want them to be too long. They get boring.
Well, how about this one? Is it just sort of when the ideas have run their course and you don't have it, then it's that, or is there a 7-minute version of this or something? Do you recall?
No, I think that was the length it was recorded.
Mm-hmm.
And it just seemed very appropriate. We just built it into that length, maybe extended it and then kept adding little colours to get it to that. But that's a great track, that Starship Bahia. It's a very good track.
All right, well, let's get the third one out. And this one I picked sort of arbitrarily. I had something else picked from one of your actual compilations, one of your collaborations. But then I ran across this Barmy Army 1989, the English Disease album. And I picked this Sharp as a Needle. I just thought this whole record was a very strange experiment of overdubbing football chants. Yeah, can you say a little about the record and this song before we hear it?
The English Disease was a term used for the football violence that was going on at the time.
Not just the fact that people really like football, and that's the English Disease. It's the actual, the violence.
No, it was actually Thatcher, the right-wing politician who destroyed lots of the government-owned things we had, like the railways, the healthcare, everything. She was responsible for trying to privatise everything. She also really didn't like council estates where people live together, and she didn't like football because of the violence. And the term, the English Disease, I named the album The English Disease, and the Barmy Army was our football team, West Ham's. We're the Barmy West Ham Army. So I did it for fun. But the track was a tribute to a great player and later manager of Liverpool called Kenny Dalglish, a Scottish player. And that track, I was building it, and weirdly, we made that rhythm, and it's Stile Scott on drums, and it's Al Jorgensen from Ministry playing the bass and the keyboards on it for me.
Thank you. Ian Rush wearing number 9 attacking as we want referee to Clive Thomas, the man who was involved in that controversial incident. Dalglish ball into the 2-4-1. It's there. Oh, beautiful running net by Dalglish. Dalglish at his best. Dalglish sharp as a needle. Dalglish drives bang with his right foot. Liverpool one behind, equalising. Now towards the head.
Yeah, so even just this initial melody that you came up with, this da 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 da, like, is that also referencing something in the?
It's melodies from football chants.
Okay, all right. And then I know the actual two chants. I guess Google is good enough now that I could ask. Yes, that
you'll
it's abide with me.
You'll
never walk alone. I picked out partly because that was also used in a Pink Floyd song. But abide with me, I would not have been able to tell. What are they singing exactly?
Yeah, it's a hymn.
Did you do these recordings of people at football games yourself?
I had a collection of vinyl of football recordings, and I thought we'd use that and the Kenny Dalglish one. Liverpool's song, as you know, is You'll Never Walk Alone, which we used a bit of, but Abide With Me was one they used to sing at the National Stadium every time there was a cup final. I just thought it would be quite rousing. And it was a tribute to a great player, even though he wasn't one of our players. He was a legend. So.
It is really interesting. I mean, I know that, you know, in American football games or sports games, there's some, maybe it'll be We Are the Champions, you know, a Queen song. It'll be something from the last century. I don't know if in our history, people are singing hymns at these games, but it seems like you have a much...
Back in those days, they used to sing some like really outrageously bad things. I took my American friends to a game, Doug Wimbish and Bernard Fowler. Do you know Bernard?
I am familiar.
Bernard sings with Mick Jagger every day. He's Mick Jagger's lead backing vocalist for the last 35 years. And he sings like a bird. He's brilliant. I took him to a West Ham Millwall, who are arch rivals. They hate each other. And he said he'd never been to anything so hostile in his life. You've got 45 minutes, the West Ham fans singing to the Millwall fans, "You'll never make the station. You'll never make the station," over and over again, saying to them, "When you get out of the ground, we're going to ambush you and you're not going to get to the train station for safety." And about 2,000 police. That was the hostile environment at the time at football games that heralded the English disease.
So when they're singing Abide With Me, a religious hymn, is it with that same sort of aggression?
They stopped singing it by the 80s, but going back to the 50s and 60s, they used to sing it quite joyously. You know, it was...
Okay, so that's when this vinyl collection is from. Is from, you know, before you, when you would be going... Or was this your childhood that you're splaying?
I've got a wall full of spoken word sound effect records. Every time I went to the States, I'd pick up things, or Italy, or Japan. I've got a collection of Japanese. So I really am obsessed with getting them and then playing them at the wrong speed, very, very slowly, and taking things off the records.
So one of the, like the sample, the glory, 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 like, are you just sort of listening around for, oh, I could use that at some point in the future. I will just make a note of where that is.
Well, that was probably recorded off one of the records as well, that had a commentary on it. And I just probably got the glory, glory, and just thought it would be amusing to put it in.
And these, when we finally get to the football announcers at the end, is that also from the archive stuff or is that newer? You know, I don't know enough about the players they're referring to.
I just stole it off a record. Okay. I just took it off a record.
So this is not, you know, a specific game praise, you know, something that you were attached with. You were saying this, the whole thing was a tribute to a particular player?
Yeah, called Kenny Dalglish. I don't know if you remember, there was a great British DJ called John Peel. John Peel helped me and lots of other people get our careers going. He's an incredible influence. And his favourite team was Liverpool. And when I put that record out, he played it almost every night on national radio. He loved, that was his favorite record that year.
So this seems pretty clearly a drum machine that you're playing on this, right? Is it?
No, that's live. That's Stile Scott drumming. That's live drums. Check it out. You'll see it moves. It's live drumming.
I mean, at least it sounds like he's playing electronic pads.
It's a synth drum. Okay. Yeah, yes. It's an electronic drum. But the rest of it, the foot drum, everything's all live. I recorded that at Southern, and I've been working with Al Jorgensen on an album, and we recorded that a couple of years before your copy. It came out as a 10-inch in about... must have been 86, that record, first.
I think the internet told me 88, but maybe there was a version before that as a single.
I think there was a 12-inch. The album was 88, I think, but the 12-inch came out first. And I'd been working on an album called Twitch with Ministry, and then he had his Fairlight, and he played on that record as well.
Okay, so Al's playing keyboard bass. Doug Wimbish played on a Shriekback album from around this period that I was thinking like, wow, that really sounds like one of those grooves. But I guess that was just what was in the air.
Yeah, no, Dougie was playing on the Barmy Army album. You've chosen some very obscure ones, but that's good. He's playing on the Barmy Army album on a few tracks as well, Dougie's.
There's not nearly the sort of sonic depth in this one as the other one to pull out a bunch of individual chunks for you. I guess we could just talk a little more generally. So you've talked a lot about sort of the consistency in the techniques from 20 years ago to now in terms of, are you still like acquiring more gear? Are you still constantly, as new technology comes out, sort of fiddling, or you have, these are my toys. I can do plenty with that. I'm fine with that.
Well, yeah, we've got relationships with Lexicon and lots of other companies. And my friend Ray Maxwell, he's a good lad. You know, my American friends send me new gear there with the company they're working with. And that's for plugins and stuff. And then I've got other people. Well, Ray actually sent us some physical stuff that was fantastic from his company. And then I've got people here who make equipment and I buy it off them, or people get us to test it for them. So I've always got, you know, funky new outboard and computer-based stuff as well.
So like on the new album, is there a track that you feel like, oh, I would not have made this, or it wouldn't sound anything like this, were it not for, like, when you get a new piece of gear, does it sort of write a song for you? I feel like that, oh, I got a new bass sound with my new phaser, and that creates a song.
One of the things that I love is Matt from Cold Cut, Ninja Tunes. He came up with this wonderful thing called the Zen Delay. And that's probably the best bit of gear in years. I love it for me because it allows me to sweep the top end of a tune and interfere with the tracks in a really cool way with the stereo. So, I mean, the Zen Delay is probably the most thing. And it's not expensive, relatively. It's a great bit of kit.
Well, that actually transitions well for the final song that we were just going to introduce, but maybe we could use this, you know, to briefly talk about your array of collaborations, relationships with other musicians. The song that I picked to conclude with was Make Up Your Mind from Outside the Echo Chamber 2017, which is Cold Cut. It is credited in Spotify to Cold Cut, On You Sound, Cecile, Todd Lattie, and Adrian Sherwood. Do you recall enough about this song, or was this just something that you spent an afternoon on?
No, we worked on it. They'd done some recordings and they got me in to help kind of finish them off. That's what happened. So it wasn't really, I can't take the credit for originating all this at all. I didn't. I just got involved with my friends and built the rhythm and yeah.
Yeah, tell me a little more, because it seemed clearly like, okay, this is a song that somebody actually wrote with a melody, and to just give the folks an example of what you do when that is put in your lap, a really nice vocal-oriented song that you then did this rhythmic stuff around. Do you have any specific memories or things to point out?
Well, we were trying to make a kind of sound system-y type record with vocalists, so we had the great Roots Maneuver and some other guests. And this track here, this young lady had a really nice voice from the Caribbean, but it wasn't Jamaica. I can't remember what island she was from. We just went into it, you know, with our hearts and did what we thought was appropriate, really.
I know nothing about Cold Cut and his other stuff. Is his general approach pretty much like yours, that he is also a producer? How does he initiate? His name is first, at least, on it.
Cold Cut was two guys, John and Matt, and they also started Ninja Tunes, which is one of the most important labels in Britain. They own that. But they're dear friends of mine from the beginning, and they just asked me to work on that record.
I got a little bit of glimpse of this through talking a couple years ago to Mark Stewart, who I know you've worked with. You mentioned earlier.
My very, very dear friend. Yeah, yeah. I miss Mark a lot.
And I didn't realize until this morning, until I was looking this up, that he had passed away a year after I talked to him, you know, 2 years ago. Very sad.
No, he was one of my best friends. We made that album, Learning to Cope with Cow. This is one of the best records I made. I love that album.
All right. Well, I will link folks to hear one of those collaborations. Yeah, he had a really interesting, you know, again, I pictured this electronic scene as people huddled around computers and talking to him and then talking to you like, no, that's not how most of these sounds are made. It's a whole different world. Very interesting to me. Well, thanks so much for talking. Anything you want to plug? Anything? You're obviously the new album and you got your shows coming up that we'll link to.
Just hello, everybody. And it's good connecting with all our friends in the States and maybe make some new friends. But the new album, The Collapse of Everything, very proud of it. Check it out. And hopefully I'll get to see some of the people who are listening to this show in March period when we'll be doing Big Ears and a show in LA and also I think Brooklyn as well, and hope maybe San Francisco as well if possible. We're coming for a first visit in a long time doing like a live dub show and look forward to it very much.
What are you working on right now? What is the next thing after this?
Well, I'm currently in the studio doing a collaboration between On You Sound, which is us, and Nightmares on Wax, which is a celebration of an album they made 20 years ago, which will be coming out in about March to coincide with the big show at the Albert Hall, which is a big venue in London. So, you know, fantastic, George and the crew, and that's what we're doing at the moment.
All right, excellent. Here is Make Up Your Mind. Thanks, Adrian.
Thanks for having me on your show. It's been great.
Long time, girl, I've had feelings for you. I know it's been hard what I've put you through. I've only been thinking by myself. I never intended to hurt you, being with someone else. My heart is yours and I'm here to let you know. Keep holding on, baby girl, don't let go. Oh, up your mind. Whoa, whoa, whoa. I wanna love you, girl, I don't wanna leave. Just wanna love you, won't you say it's for keeps. Whoa, whoa, whoa. It's been a long time, girl, I've had feelings for you. I know it's been hard what I've put you through. I've only been thinking about myself. I never intended to hurt you, being with someone else. My heart is yours and I'm here to let you know. Keep holding on, baby girl. Inside it for me got a torrent. Within me none had it and it had fancy sin. She say me want the girl to me vulnerable. My heart is yours and I'm here to let you know. Girl, keep holding on, baby girl. Just wanna love you, make up your mind. Oh, 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 oh. I wanna love you, girl, I don't wanna leave. Just wanna love you, say it's for keeps. Oh, 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 oh.
Thanks so much to Adrian. Learn more about his material at adriansherwood.com. I hope you're subscribed to this podcast, Nakedly Examined Music. You can find the links to do that at nakedlyexaminedmusic.com, and I will link to other works of Adrian's, different collaborations he's done. There's one video that actually shows him twiddling the knobs on his equipment, so you can hear what he's talking about. My next interview is with a very interesting singer-songwriter named Jonathan Rundman, currently based in Minneapolis. And then I just this week recorded another discussion episode on humor in music with some returning guests, Don Ralph from Life in a Blender, and a couple of guys that I've had on my Pretty Much Pop podcast on the panels there. If you want to make sure you get your episodes of mine as quickly as possible, sometimes minutes or days before they show up on the public feed, why, you want to go to patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. That will get you all the episodes completely ad-free, occasional bits of bonus material, but mostly it lets me know that you want this podcast to continue and are willing to put a very small amount of money behind that. Hope everybody's doing well. Keep on musicking. Until next time, this is Mark Linsenmeyer signing off.